Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
And a 1-2 pitch to Chris Davis. Swung on and missed. Carrasco gets him his seventh strikeout of the night. The A's strand a pair. And an overturned call keeps this a scoreless game through six. He launches one to deep right. Is it fair or is it foul? It is gone! Carlos Santana with home run number 27. Puts the first run of the night on the scoreboard.
He was standing at home plate, Matt, like, oh my goodness, please stay fair, and it just barely does.
Wow, look at that, and on the run. Look at this kid run. Josh Gordon.
Looked like Reedman wasn't expecting that pass, but it goes for Gordon, who's got the ball, and a Cleveland Brown touchdown. He was working on Will Blackman, a 21-yard strike.
Josh Gordon, already over 100 yards.
Please look at
him. He's got Gordon, touchdown Browns.
Especially even in the preseason, all the guys don't take that serious. Every opportunity to get out there, show what you can do. I think it means a lot, and you guys should take it seriously, and I definitely do take it seriously, and I'd like to have fun while I'm doing here. Away from the field, I mean, like I said, it's a lot of mental reps in meetings, taking a lot more notes, trying to pick up the offense a lot quicker compared to other guys that's been here. They've been here a long time, so I got a lot of room to have. But I feel just as strong, just as fast as I ever felt before, if not stronger, if not faster. We'll see how my production is, and we'll go from there once they evaluate and get some stuff on film, and at least I'll be able to tell how I feel once I get out there.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Onward and upward on a Tuesday afternoon edition of the Extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo's sports leader. Had a really, really great show yesterday. Looking forward to another outstanding one today. Although the montage, a little slower than normal in the business side of things. Tigers were off last night, so we had a little Indians highlight there for you, but nothing else from the American League Central race. And then the big news of the day in the NFL, at least among the teams that we're covering, as the Browns work out down in Tampa with the Buccaneers all week, and then they get set for their preseason game number 3 at Raymond James Stadium at the end of the week with the Buccaneers. The rumor across the league is that teams are hitting up the Browns front office and saying, hey, we'd really, really love to talk to you about a trade for Josh Gordon. They're interested in bringing Josh Gordon in, knowing that he's a free agent after this season, and that maybe the Browns would consider taking something in order to pass him off, thinking they might not be able to or might not want to re-sign him to a massive deal given his long history of unavailability due to drug use. So Josh Gordon, could he possibly be on the block? Those two big stories you just heard in the montage as we get you started today. We have a lot of other things to talk about, including contracts in the National Football League. But not any individual contract, not Matthew Stafford getting paid whenever that happens, not, the big bucks being thrown around currently, but about future bucks and future rules within the National Football League as it pertains to the collective bargaining agreement. We teased it yesterday, but did not have a lot of opportunity to talk about it because we were loaded for bear with a lot of good baseball talk and more on our Monday program. But Steelers player rep Ramon Foster announcing basically to all of the players who still think they're going to be hanging around in the league by 2021, that's 5 years away. And most careers in the NFL last just 3.5 years maximum. So why these guys want to start giving up money now in order to save money for a day that may never come in which they are part of the next collective bargaining agreement, that's a question we're going to talk about. But Ramon Foster in the headlines for that story. The Madden ratings are out. Guess who's the maddest about Madden? I'll give you a hint. He's a Cowboy, and he's not happy at all about his Madden rating. We're going to talk a little bit about that. Lions kicker says teams are going to continue to try short kickoffs. We didn't get to this story yesterday either because of the kickoff rules. Kevin Durant says his Olympic experience was a good thing for him. It was a better thing for the Cleveland Cavaliers. And if you're wondering what in the living hell I'm talking about, you'll hear, I will explain a little bit later on in this hour, I hope, Kevin Durant, how his Olympic experience was a good thing for the Cavaliers because of what it revealed about KD. I'll explain all of that as we go. And Tim Tebow, back in the news because he is counting down the days now. 1 week from today, he will be working out on August 30th in Los Angeles, and at least 20 major league teams have decided to send scouts. 20 out of 30 have said, yep, we'll come and watch him swing the bat, take some fly balls, see what the arm looks like from the outfield, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So they're going to attend his workout. That, of course, has a lot of people talking about whether or not it's warranted, deserved, or if these teams are interested in his baseball ability at all, or if they're worried, or if they're interested more in the draw that he could be for their clubs if he was associated with them in any way, even if he's in their minor league system. So all of those are top stories on the program today as we get you started right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Jim Cushlin is here as well. And Cush, I'm not sure where to start other than you played a couple of the highlights, not a lot of them.
No.
Last night out in Oakland, where the only game involving American League Central teams that we're watching closely and had the Cleveland Indians winning yet again, and the Indians take down the Oakland A's behind a gem from Carlos Carrasco. 8 innings, 4 hits, struck out 9, did not walk a batter, gave up obviously 0 runs in a 1-0 shutout win. Carrasco has now struck out 8 or more hitters in 4 consecutive starts, the longest active streak in the majors, and another reason, another example, that pitching staff as to why the lead, which is now 7.5 over the Tigers, 8.5 in the loss column, why the lead over the Tigers might be insurmountable by the time, I'm trying to say.
There you go.
We get to flip the calendar over from August to September.
Yeah, and on that, it almost feels like the following two factoids I'm going to throw out there kind of piggyback on what we were talking about on this subject yesterday and with Evan Woodbury of the Tigers beat on M Live. With that win, 7.5 up in the division, that's a season high. 21 games over 500, also a season high, and it's August 23rd. That, to me, kind of sums up some things right there.
And I think the latter number is very, very likely to grow, maybe more than the former. Oh, the reason I say that,
well, think
is
of it this way, 91-71, a common record, that's 20 over 500. So they're right in that kind of ballpark right now.
Right, but they're one game over that right
actually,
now.
Actually, yes, correct.
Right, and what I mean is more likely to grow to be 22 over 500 and 23, given the fact that they have the A's. And the A's are a team that is kind of a wreck right now. They're 19 games under 500, which is a season worse for them, and they just suspended two players, or actually fined two players for fighting in the clubhouse over endorsement deals.
Right, yeah, the A's are kind of a mess. Billy Bean's got to do some different things, obviously. We'll see, but for the Indians, you get that kind of pitching, and you needed it yesterday. I mean, it's another one of those situations. Young guy who most of us have never heard of because he's still relatively new to the majors, and they throw a jab. It's always like that with young pitchers. Either they look like Cy Young or they get absolutely lit up. There just seems
for
to be
a short period of time anyway.
Yes, correct. Yeah. And clearly he was on the good side of it for one of the kids yesterday, and that forced a gem from Carrasco, and it doesn't get decided till late. It was obviously on the West Coast, so debatable on who may have stayed up. I know I didn't.
I had to wake up this morning
honest,
to find out.
I'll be honest, I was having trouble sleeping, and I flipped back on it, right, kid you not, at the top of the eighth, and it was about 11:45, almost midnight at that point.
Yeah,
because it was quick. It was already a 0-0 game, so at least for a West Coast game, it was quicker. I was surprised it was that late, so I got to see the best parts, if you will.
All right, there you go. I wasn't going to stay up for that late for it, and it wasn't even a long game as West Coast games go. I mean, it was
right.
It was a pitcher's duel, so it was a lot of 3 up and 3 down. So it wasn't a terribly long game, but I just wasn't going to stay up for it. I figured I'd see what happened this morning. And what I saw happen this morning, obviously, was a good thing as an Indians fan, and that is that the Indians moved that lead to 7.5 now. So here's where we sit going into today's games. You have the Tigers, and they've got a really, really nice break here in that they have the Twins, the bottom of the division, one of the worst teams in baseball. Twins are in a bad way, too. They've lost four in a row. In addition to being 49-75, they've lost four in a row. So,
and for what it's worth, it's Anibal Sanchez on the mound for the Tigers tonight. And, you know, about a month and a half ago, that would have been obvious, instantaneous, cringeworthy, but to his credit, he's had a few good starts in a row now.
Yeah, and again, he's going against the Twins, so right. You know, if he's going to go, this is probably
a good
place for him.
The Tigers don't seem to have a problem with the Twins the way the Indians do.
Yeah, exactly. The Indians, by the way, are not in necessarily a great situation tonight either, because we just don't know what they're going to get from Danny Salazar. Salazar goes tonight against Manea for the Oakland Athletics, again back out there on the West Coast. And Salazar's one start since he was on the DL was, of course, that one inning job in which he was just obviously not ready. And hopefully he is going to be more returning to his first half and first right. 3 months or 4 months of the season form. Tonight.
So, yeah, the hindsight on that first Salazar start is simply, Bob, they probably should have given him a rehab assignment.
Yeah,
so he
exactly.
came straight
they should
back.
Have and didn't, and that's why they put him in the bull. They probably realized that and said, he can't just go one inning now and then not pitch again for 5 days. They put him in the bullpen, and they got a requisite number of
right.
pitches to make sure that he is getting ready. So, so we'll see. That's why I said a moment ago when you gave us those two stats, the biggest lead they've had, 7.5, biggest deficit for the Tigers. And then biggest margin over 500. The second one I think can build tonight and tomorrow. I don't know about the first one, though, because I would expect, even if the Indians win, the Tigers ought to be able to handle the Twins. Now, the other team, of course, to look at here and talk about, as long as we stay on baseball for a moment or two, is the resurgent Royals. This is what the Royals have done the last couple of years, and this is the question, is can they do it again? The Kansas City Royals, just they become a pain in the rear end. They will not go away. They become gnats, and then you swat at them, and you can't get them, and then they come back at you, and they nip you here, and they nip you there, and pretty sudden, a team that was down, what, 11 games in the standings, Jim?
Yep.
As recently as a week ago? Are now down just 8.5 games, nipping at the heels of the Detroit Tigers for second and pushing up toward a possible wild card berth. And I promise you, if they find a way to sneak in and creep in to the American League playoffs, nobody is going to want to play them in the first round. You know, if they end up taking one of the spots away from, you know, either Baltimore, and right now as it stands, the wild cards would be Boston and Baltimore, correct?
Yes. You'll have all three teams from the East as it stands
now. And then
now.
You have Texas, then you have Seattle trying to catch Texas. They're still in the mix, of course, trying to take one of those spots. So is Houston, potentially. And then the Tigers and the Royals. But if the Royals were to somehow rise up, I don't think anybody wants them in the first round.
No, because this is still a team.
Because this is their time of year.
Yeah, and this is still a team that has won the last two AL pennants and is still the defending champion until they're done. I would say the only thing on the Royals is, it's still contingent on how much they can stretch that starting rotation, which is just not as good. Especially, it's not on the Indians level, and to some degrees, it's not even on a healthy Tigers
agreed.
Level.
I agree.
And that's been the thing that started this tailspin. Then you had some injuries and a few ineffectiveness in their lineup, and that's why they were, considering what they've done the last couple of years, that's why they were so bad for so long. The only question now is, it's four back in the wild card. I wouldn't put them in the discussion for the division because they're still technically behind the Tigers in the standings by a game.
By a game.
And
right.
That's the other thing. Even if you look at the wild card, they're still behind the Astros, Tigers, Mariners, and the giant pileup of the East teams that are either winning the division or in the wild card lead. So basically they have three teams to climb over to even get to a spot. And sometimes the way baseball works, that's at times can be trickier than just how many games out you are.
Yeah, you're right. It can be. There's how many people are in front of you sometimes is indeed a bigger obstacle. But look at how fast they closed those numbers that you just mentioned, though. Do you realize that in the month of July, they were 7-19?
Yep.
They were 7-19 in July. They started out July with a 3-8 mark in their first 11, and they closed it at 1-8. Okay, so three of their last, they lost 8 of 11, and then they lost 7 of 8 at the beginning and end of that month. At that point, at the end of the month, they were 49-55, 12. I said 11 before, Jim. 12 games out of first place in the AL Central and 8.5 back in the wild card race. Now they're 8.5 back of the division and just 4.5 in the wild card race. So in other words, they're hot streak. Now, we saw the Tigers go on an 8-game winning streak too, right? And it did not. It was not something they were able to build on. It was not something they were able to use to close the gap well enough to take over the Central Division. And now they've fallen back into, you know, kind of a 500 type malaise over the last couple of weeks.
Or as I've worded it, they lost a whole month's worth of work.
Indeed, that's very fair to say. Now, will the Royals do the same thing? It's entirely possible. This is a team that, again, has just been on a roll. The Tigers have won 8 in a row, 9 of their last 10. They've closed that gap in the wild card standings from 8.5 down to 4.5 out of the final wild card spot, and they've done it in relatively short order because of that streak. Truth be told, I think because of their experience in the last 2 years, they are in a better position to build on that 8-game win streak and make sure it isn't just wasted, like you said, a month's worth of work, the way that the Tigers kind of did. I think they are just a little bit more seasoned, a little bit more poised, a little bit more confident. The defending world champions, for God's sake, why would you not be? If anybody can take that 8-game win streak and build on it, not saying it'll be a 12-game win streak, but say this is a team that's still going to continue to win series coming off of it, 2 out of 3 and 3 out of 4 as the opportunities present themselves, much more so than the Tigers were able to do in the wake of their streak. And that's why I think they are a factor in the wild card chase, even though they're 4.5 back of that final spot, and even, as you point out, with the number of teams that they would have to leapfrog.
And
it's still, as I said about the Tigers yesterday, in the chances to win the division, it might be slim, but it's still August 22nd, not September 22nd. There's still 5 weeks of baseball left.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why the key for the Royals' perspective, even with that possible confidence, is they can't, as you said, fall into a malaise. They can't go and play 500 baseball for the next 2 weeks. Because, you know, to put in perspective, for example, the win streak has gotten them to within 4 in the wild card, and they're 4 over .500, right? The Orioles, who still hold one of the spots, and given the way the AL East is gone, that seems to fluctuate every couple days.
Yeah, it does.
They hold the road wildcard spot, and they're at 12 over .500. Then the Red Sox and Blue Jays are both 16 over .500. So there's a gap there. And playing 500 baseball with those teams at the top, you can't still be 3 to 6 games out and only about 3 to 5 games above .500 in two and a half weeks from now.
No, you can't, but here's the thing. Because of the base, you know, the unbalanced baseball schedule, which is a good thing, and that might not be the right way to word it, but because of the number of games they're going to play against the teams in their own division down the stretch, the Orioles, Red Sox, and Blue Jays are going to continue to beat up on one another, perhaps all of them playing, you know, roughly 500 baseball. If they have an equal number of games and they kind of treat each other equally, if you will.
Sure.
And that could give an opportunity to a team like the Royals to grow, to grow. And I don't have their schedule in front of me, but to climb faster if they stay hot. Because I'm assuming just like they're going to have the Indians and the Tigers, they're going to have the White Sox and Twins down the stretch, which of course are some of the weaker teams.
Yeah, everybody basically plays their own division down the stretch.
Exactly. Exactly.
And to that end, incidentally, the Royals are 34-17 against the Central. To put that in perspective, Indians are 33-17, Tigers are 20-27. So they already this season have a tendency, like the Indians, with the exception of the Twins, to beat up on their own division.
Yeah, that is exactly, you know, I'll tell you what, Jim, I don't know how this is going to play out. I don't know what Seattle's got left on their schedule. Boston, I mean, other than, like you said, they're going to play within their own division like everybody does down the stretch. But between Seattle, Kansas City, Detroit, Boston, and Baltimore, I'm not ready to just say there's too many teams to climb. The teams that are in the driver's seat now are the teams to beat in those. I'm not ready to say that. I think it's going to be very, very interesting in the next 5 weeks. And if the Royals stay hot, then the Royals, you know, have done this before. And that's a team that's kind of in the way. All right, let's see. All right, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take a quick time out here because we're going to shift gears, and we're going to get to a sports center. And on the other side of the sports center, we're going to go to some NFL discussion. Scott Petrak is going to join us. The Browns are down in Tampa, and they are practicing 4 straight days of co-workouts, or practicing, if you will, with the Buccaneers, and then they'll play on Friday. But the biggest news has nothing to do with what's going on at practice. The biggest news is what's going on in the front office. As phones apparently continue to ring from general managers across the National Football League with offers to trade for Josh Gordon. Question is what kind of a haul do you think there could be for a guy who 3 years ago led the NFL in receiving yards in just 14 games and looked like he was just an all pro to come? but a guy who has only played five games in the last 2 years. A guy who has been suspended repeatedly and was banned from the league until he applied for reinstatement and got put back in. How much value would there be, and is it something the Browns could or would should consider? So we're going to talk about that coming up with Scott Petrak, as well as a couple of the labor issues, the ones brought about by Ramon Foster or brought up by Ramon Foster against Roger Goodell and the owners when it comes to the CBA. So all of that stuff on the table as well. We'll get to Scott Petrak coming right up after SportsCenter on ESPN 106.5, The Ticket.
Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5, The Ticket.
Rolling on, are we? It's 3:33. The Bob France Extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket. We're going to shift gears from Major League Baseball back into the NFL now. The Browns are down in Tampa, Florida. They are working out with the Buccaneers for the week. Then they will play them in a preseason game at the end of the week. But most of the action involving the Browns right now is taking place in the front office as the phones are ringing. Apparently, numerous teams, according to multiple reports, have been contacting the Browns with trade offers, or at least to inquire as to the availability of a newly reinstated. Technically, he's still under suspension. You know, it's really weird. The way the NFL did this whole thing, he is still suspended until week five, and yet they are allowing him to play and practice with the Browns and play in the preseason games, and he is expected to play, of course, in the third preseason game. So it's just kind of one of those odd things. It feels like he's back, but he's not back. He's sitting in a situation where he can play for a little while, then he has to depart from the club and not be near the club during the 4 week suspension at the start of the season. So Josh Gordon is kind of back, and other teams are very interested in perhaps seeing if the Cleveland Browns are interested in kind of ending their long, strange odyssey with the very talented but very rarely available wide receiver. Joining us to talk about it is Scott Petrak, Browns beat writer out in Cleveland. Scott, thanks so much for the time this fine Tuesday afternoon. How are you?
I'm good, Bobby. How are you?
I'm good. Scott, first things first, what do you understand about Josh Gordon's contract? Is he a restricted free agent after this year?
You know what, Bob? I know when he got suspended by the team at the end of 14 for that one game, the season finale.
Right.
It pushed back his contract, and then his agent was going to appeal, Drew Rosenhaus. And last time I checked in with him, it depended on if he got reinstated, would they take that up again? And Drew thought that they would. But I think they're kind of taking a wait and see kind of approach to it. So I expect him to be under the Browns kind of control for another year after this.
But probably if he's a free agent, then it would be restricted. So they would still have the right to match anything anybody offered him, right?
Yeah, but I
mean, I'm looking, I don't know. I mean, SportTrack is a good site, to check these things. And I know what you're saying. That's the reason I asked, because they are listing 2017 as a restricted free agent year. I don't know if that changed because of, as you said, the appeal over the five games and whether or not that should have counted as a year, of service for him toward his, you know, move toward free agency.
Sure. And right now it's not. Right now he wouldn't be restricted until 17. But Drew, I believe, would challenge that. Although, you know, he's got a good relationship with the Browns front office right now in the reinstatement. So maybe he's going to let that one slide. But I still think it's something to keep an eye on. But it's premature just because Josh hasn't even, you know, he won't even be reinstated completely until week five.
Yeah, exactly right, and it is very premature. But the only reason I even ask, of course, Scott, is because why are these teams suddenly blowing up the Browns' phone and saying, hey, we want to trade for this guy? If he's under team control, and it's a very, very team-friendly contract right now in terms of his salary because of the situation he finds himself in, I don't know why the Browns would even feel inclined to pick up the phone. And like I said, unless they know something that we don't know, that maybe he's going to be a free agent and the Browns aren't going to want to pay him a huge amount of money, given his undependability or unreliability in his early career, and they don't want to watch him walk without anything in return.
All right. Now, I know what you're saying. That's what the interesting thing to me about the story today. The teams are interested and the Browns aren't interested in getting, you know, in shipping Josh out is I find it a difficult situation for both sides to come to any kind of agreement. You know, any team wouldn't be willing to give up enough for the Browns to part with one of their most talented players really in franchise history. You know, and I'm not saying productive players, but I think he's one of the most talented guys to ever put on a Bronze uniform. So in order to give up on a guy like that, the offer would have to be high enough, and yet there's no team that would offer, put out a high enough offer because of all the baggage that Josh brings with him, including the fact that he could be indefinitely suspended one day from now.
Yeah, exactly right, and that's one of the bizarre things about this. You know, I mean, I can't imagine what the trade value would be, what the market value would be for a guy who 3 years ago led the league in receiving in only 14 games, but yet is it, you know, played, what, five games in the last 2 years. So I don't understand what anybody would be offering. Would it be a conditional first-round pick or a conditional second-round pick or a conditional third- and fourth-round pick or something? In other words, if he plays and doesn't get suspended again, your compensation goes higher, and you get a higher pick of as far as what we'll give you. And if he doesn't play, well, then it's going to be very low because neither one of us were going to have him available to us anyway.
Right. I mean, that would make sense. But then if you're the Browns, in order for you to get that, let's say, first-round pick, because Josh is a first-round talent, in order for you to get that, he would have to go somewhere else and have success. So then you're feeling bad that you let the guy get away from you. So I just don't see the incentive for the Browns to get rid of him. The only caveat to that would be, let's say there's a playoff team that loses one of their big-time receivers. You know, I don't know, if Denver loses Demaryius Thomas and has a second-round pick to give up, you know, maybe the Browns say, you know, okay, we'll do it in this. In this circumstance, we're getting what we think is fair value for Josh, knowing that we could lose him at any time and that, you know, a year or two down the road, we could lose him in free agency. But even that, I'm not sure the Browns would be willing to part with him, but I think that's the only way it could happen.
Yeah, I mean, I understand your thinking, and you're right. He's first-round talent, so you're, like you said, if you get a first-round pick for him, great, but if he goes and performs somewhere else, you're going to wish he was performing for you, but that's the roll of the dice. You know, you're assuring yourself of getting a first-round player in return, because you know that isn't going to, the first-round pick, meaning as a non-entity, not a person, but an actual pick as cash, isn't going to go out there and get suspended. You're going to be able to make a pick in the first round in the next draft with that guy. Whereas with Josh, you don't know when he is one more, you know, night away from his team and bad decision away from being suspended again. So, you know, you're right. Both are first round values. One is an actual player that has done it. One is a guy who could be a star in a future first round pick. The question is whether you want to roll the dice with the former. You know the latter is guaranteed.
Right. Well, I do think if somebody offered him a first-round pick, I think the Browns would probably take it. But when you talk about conditionally a first-round pick, then it doesn't make sense to me. Because then there's no real upside for you giving him away, because if he performs to the level of the first-round pick, then it's not worth it. But if a team said, yes, we'll give you a first-round pick for Josh Gordon, I think the Browns would probably do it, knowing that there's no certainty when you keep Josh.
Right. That makes sense. We're talking to Scott Petrak, and we're just kicking around these very interesting Josh Gordon trade rumors that have been kind of floating around today. And to be clear, these were not floated around by the Cleveland Browns. These are being floated by media who are reporting that other teams are contacting the Browns front office and saying, hey, is he available? Let's talk about what it would take. Jim Cushing, go ahead.
You know, and I'm thinking more and more about this, guys, and I'm trying to read into how restricted free agency in the NFL kind of works a little bit. Because I've been thinking about this ever since I saw that he may actually be a restricted free agent. If he is, would the fact that he was a supplemental draft pick come into play? What I mean by that is, say he has an outstanding year, turns out he is a restricted free agent, and somebody offers him something that Jimmy Haslam doesn't want to match. Well, in the NFL, you get a draft pick compensation based on where the player was, but Josh Gordon's a supplemental pick, so how does that work out? Because we're kind of in rare territory. Restricted free agents, by the way, don't come up very often because you have to play about 3 years only, and most rookie contracts nowadays are 4 years. That's why this doesn't come up very often. But Scott, do you by any chance know that Josh Gordon being a supplemental draft pick, not a normal draft pick originally,
right,
would that come into play in these possible scenarios?
Yeah, I don't know for certain. My guess is that it would be the second round pick, because he was a second round pick in a supplemental draft, but I don't know that for certainty. But here, the fact is, if he puts up a year like he did in 2013 this year, or even approaches it, and the Browns get good vibes out of Josh Gordon, then they would try to lock him up long term. I mean, this isn't a guy that once you have in your building and you can see what Josh could do, you would want to let leave the building. Now, you have to put in all kinds of stipulations that, you know, it's not guaranteed money, and that if he, you know, got suspended again, it would default and all those kind of things. But I think if Josh keeps himself clean and performs at a level that he's shown he can, then I think the Browns would try to get a deal done so that Josh is a member of the Browns. Because I don't think you want to put in all this work, go through all this hassle to let him walk through the door after a year or two. Walk out the door.
Now, having said all of that, let's talk about who he is and what he is. Joe Haden said, I don't know if it was yesterday, I think it was yesterday, that covering him in practice since he's been able to come back from the quad, that he is having a whale of a time with him because he said Josh Gordon doesn't look one bit different. He said he hasn't changed a bit from that season 3 years ago in which he led the NFL in receiving in only 14 games.
That's true, Bob. He's a little thicker, you know, and he needs to drop a few pounds, and I think that's natural when you haven't played any football and he's been dealing with that quad injury. Besides that, he looks like Josh Gordon that I remember, and it's been a long time. He's smooth, he's fast, he's quick, gets in and out of his breaks. The ease with which he catches balls, I'm not saying he never drops one, but he catches most of them, and it's all hands, and it's easy. He plucked a ball off the back of a cornerback the other day running down the sideline like it was nothing. He made a catch in the corner of the end zone. He just looks like you'd want your receivers to look. I mean, really. And he gets open, and he can get open on a variety of routes. And I think when you look, compare Josh Dugalik to Terrell Pryor, who's making that conversion. Terrell can run certain routes. He can run the deep ball. He can throw a hitch to him, maybe a fade. Josh can run every route. And we saw it in that huge year of 2014, where he would run a slant and separate from Aqib Talib. He made a play against Jacksonville where he went up, caught the ball, stopped on a dime, and exploded for a 95-yard touchdown. There's just not a whole lot of guys in this world that can do that.
Where do you think he would rank if he didn't have the four-game suspension at the start? And I asked this with the backdrop of the Madden ratings that came out today. Des Bryant's furious. Des Bryant was rated 90 on Madden, and I think that was eighth best among wide receivers. And it started with, I want to say, Antonio Brown with the 97, and then Julio Jones at 96, Odell Beckham, a little under that, and all the way down to Des Bryant. And Des Bryant was just really, really angry. You know how seriously these guys take sure. that sort of thing. Because they really see it as a barometer of how they're viewed and how good they are at their position in the National Football League. If Josh Gordon didn't have to sit these first four and was just coming back, where do you suppose he would rank in that rating?
I think from a physically gifted standpoint, that he's more physically gifted than Des Bryant. He runs faster, and I think he probably jumps higher. I think he's a Julio Jones comparison. I think they're built similarly. Mm-hmm. I think they run the same kind of time. So Julio's had more success in this league. His numbers are better because he's been on the field more.
Yeah, exactly.
I rank him a couple notches below Julio.
So he could be top five.
Yeah, Bobby has that kind of talent. And all you have to do is go back to that 13th season when he led the league in 14 games, set a Browns franchise record. That just shows you what he can do. Now, for Josh, it'll be a consistency question because he hasn't been able to stack 2 years together. When he came back in 14 for those last six games and he got suspended for the finale, he wasn't the same player. And I don't know if that's the Browns forced too much on his plate when he came back. He wasn't happy. You know, the Browns tried to, you know, trying to make a playoff run and they counted on him and he didn't show up for him. So who knows where his head was at that time, but talent-wise, he's in a top-five player, and now he just has to show consistently they can do it game in, game out, and season in, season out.
We're talking to Scott Petrak, talking about Josh Gordon and his potential impact with the Browns or with another team, since there are a bunch of teams blowing up the Browns front office phones with trade offers for Josh Gordon. I'm trying to remember, who was the Browns quarterback in 2013 when he caught all those passes? Was it Hoyer? Was that a Hoyer?
A lot of wheat. No, it was a lot of Whedon that year. The memories that I have of Josh making big plays, a lot of it was with Brandon Whedon. I think Hoyer got into some of those games.
That's the reason I asked is because, and by the way, how sad is it that we can't remember? The position changes. There's more turnover there, honest to God, than there is at a temp agency at the Browns quarterback position. It's just next guy, next guy, next guy, next guy. I can't remember who it was. The only reason I asked that, Scott, is – Robert Griffin III is the only proven NFL quarterback, and he really only proved it for the 1 year, his rookie year, but he is extraordinarily talented. He was a first-round draft pick, you know, a very high first-round draft pick. A team gave up a boatload of picks for him. He responded with an offensive rookie of the year season, and he, of course, has struggled since that time, since his injury with Haloti Ngata. But I'm trying to think of if Josh Gordon is healthy and plays 12 games after sitting those first four. Robert Griffin could be just exactly what he needs, and vice versa, because Robert Griffin, as we know, has such a great touch on a deep ball. He sometimes isn't the best at making decisions and making them quickly, which is one of the criticisms Jay Gruden always had about him in Washington. But we know that he's got a cannon, and we know he puts great touch on the ball. We saw it in the Terrell Pryor throws in the preseason thus far, and Gary Barnage with that second touchdown last week. I'm just picturing how good Josh Gordon could be with Robert Griffin being the guy throwing him deep balls and vice versa, given the fact that Gordon has shown the ability to go out there and just torch people.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it, Bob. And they have the connection from Baylor. I mean, they played together. They have that chemistry. And I think this is the kind of offense that Hugh Jackson is setting up. It's going to be a big play, stretch the field, run the ball. So you try to bring the safeties into the box because you're going to run it, and then you go over the top, because there's only going to be one safety deep, and you can stretch the field with Terrell Pryor, Josh Gordon, and Corey Coleman. I think that's what he wants to do, and I think that plays into Robert Griffin's strengths, because he does throw a nice deep ball. And if you can mix up, or if you can add in the threat of RG3 running the ball, that even affects the defense more, and it makes him play honest, and then you get one-on-one coverage. And Josh has shown that you can't cover him one-on-one. Keith Tlaib is one of the best corners in the league.
Right.
And he couldn't do it when he's playing with New England and Bill Belichick. Josh Gordon lit him up, and they should have won in Foxborough, and they blew an onside kick at the end of a game because Josh Gordon played so well. So I think it is a good combination, and that's why there's some excitement around Berea. Their defense might be terrible, but there's reason to believe that the offense could have some success. And going back to 13, it was a combination of Whedon, Hoyer, and Jason Campbell that year.
Oh, there you go. Okay, I forgot about Jason Campbell. That's right. They had a three-headed monster there at various points in time. Scott, just real quick, a couple of other things regarding the NFL overall before you go, and really appreciate the discussion on Josh Gordon and the whole thing about trying to inquire about his availability. A couple of league-wide things here. The Lions kicker is talking about the rule that's going to have touchbacks being at the 25 now, and he says this is going to lead. Remember, they moved the kickoff line closer so they would create more touchbacks, so they don't have as many high speed collisions on kickoffs. That's the reason. But now that they're going to go ahead and move the touchbacks to the 25 yard line, Sam Martin is saying teams aren't even going to bother kicking it out of bounds. That's too much. They're not going to kick it through the end zone and get the touchback. They're going to short kick. They're going to kick high, shorter kicks, you know, somewhere inside the 10-yard line, almost punt style, to try to pin them down closer or further back, if you will, depending on your point of view, than the 25-yard line. So, in other words, by continuing to try to fix things that aren't broken, the NFL may have just created more high-speed collisions than they had before they ever started tinkering with the kickoff line.
I agree. I think it's an unintended consequence, and I think that's how teams are going to approach the kickoff. Now, there's a couple exceptions to that. If you know for sure your guy can boot the ball out of the end zone, you're playing in a dome or you're playing in Denver, maybe you just let the guy wind up and boot it out of the end zone, and you save everybody the hassle, and you don't risk giving up a possible kickoff return for a touchdown. And the other exception is if you have a stud kick return, right? If a Devin Hester's back there or a Josh Cribbs, those guys in their prime, maybe you say, you know what, it's not worth the risk of popping it up to the 5-yard line. But if you just have, if you're not worried about that, then I think you're going to see most kickoffs be popped up to about the goal line or the 1-yard line and ask your guys to go cover it. And odds are good that you're going to tackle them not only inside the 25, but probably inside the 20, because kickers and coverage has gotten so good that they can pin them on they can pin a guy on the sideline, and they get down so fast that you don't see a whole lot of long kickoff returns anymore.
I completely agree, and that's kind of my point. In order to cover, in order to be down there and doing that and pinning them inside the 25 to make it worth the while, or even better, inside the 20, you're going to have a lot more of those high-speed collisions. It's going to be like punts because, you know, they're close enough where they can really, really just sky the kick and pop it up almost, and by the time it comes down, there's going to be 10 guys, you know, scrambling in the returner's face, and there are going to be guys getting smacked. Which is fine with me. I mean, this is football. These guys know what they're doing before they get on the field anyway. My question is if they start charting the number of collisions and number of injuries on kickoffs, and they've already been doing that on extra points and other things, that's how they decided to move the point back and try to discourage the two-point play or what have you. Once they start charting these stats, I wonder if they see an increase in injuries now because of this, if they're just going to make that next step and say, you know what? Because where did he at? Who was it? Oh, this was college. I apologize. It was the Big 12 commissioner, I think it was, who said if we can figure out a way to account for the onside kick, he said there is a huge, huge movement of support in college football to just get rid of the kickoffs altogether in the name of safety. It's just you'll start on the 20-yard line or the 25-yard line with every possession, and away we go. The only thing they have to account for is the onside kick. You think we'll ever get there?
I don't. I wouldn't rule it out just because I know that's where it's headed, and I know the discussion that goes on inside the NFL and their focus on player safety, and they really think that they've, for some reason, they've targeted the kickoff. But I think it's so drastic, and I think there is a counter movement against it, and there's resistance to getting rid of the kickoff. There's resistance to moving, you know, letting the touchback go to the 25. So what I see happening is this year you see too many popped up kickoffs. Maybe you see more injuries, but you for sure don't see a decrease in injuries or a decrease at least in the number of kickoff returns. I think you're going to see more kickoff returns, and the league will go back to what it used to do, which is you return it to the 20, and then you might see teams go back to kicking the ball out of the end zone because then the risk-reward makes sense. We can deal with the 20, and I know it's only 5 yards, but it does make a big difference if your defensive coordinator is saying, give them the ball at the 20 versus giving it to them at the 25.
Last thing, Scott, this is another just general NFL question. Steelers player rep to the NFLPA, Ramon Foster, got a lot of tongues wagging yesterday when he started to warn players, current players, to start saving your money. Start putting money away in a nest egg, if you will, so that you can ride out a lockout in 2021 or a strike. Because he said when the next collective bargaining agreement is negotiated, they're going to play hardball. They're going to play hardball over drugs because they are really, really angry about all of the guys, including Josh Gordon. Martavis [S2] Right. [S1] Bryant, his teammate with the Steelers, gone for this entire season because of marijuana, repeated violations. Le'Veon Bell, an all-pro running back, is going to miss 3 games because of it. So I don't know if this is why his motivating factor was his own teammates. But we can all relate because we've seen this. But the drugs are going to be an issue. A bigger piece of the pie is going to be an issue. More guaranteed money is going to be an issue. We know the NFL players were very vocal as the NBA handed out those incredible contracts just in the last 2 months in their free agency period. What do you think of this notion that the players are going to find a way to play hardball here and negotiate guaranteed contracts? And do you think anybody's going to pay attention in 2016, 17, 18 as the paychecks come in? Is anybody going to be putting money in a separate account for strike pay come 2021?
Yeah, I get a couple thoughts on that. Number one, you know, that's 5 years away. I bet it's only 20% of the league will still be in the league. So
bingo.
These guys should I'm not sure they need to plan that way. Because if you're still playing in the league 5 years from now, you've made a good chunk of money. You're probably a quarterback. So I don't know if you need to start squirreling that money away. I don't know if they'll ever be able to get guaranteed money in the NFL. You would think that they would have had it by now if they were going to get it. So maybe they're fine to take a hardline stance on something like marijuana. And, you know, those kind of sub issues, because they can have wins on those. You know, I think the owners are willing to concede on those type of issues. And we saw at the last collective bargaining agreement, Josh Gordon, the reason he played at all in 2014 was because they softened the drug policy. So I could see them softening the drug policy, even removing the marijuana stipulation. And that wouldn't be a shocker to me. But where the NFL draws a line in the sand is they're saying revenue, guaranteed contracts, and the power of the commissioner. And the league or the players, the union, to me, if they're going to fight something, they might want to fight the power of the commissioner, because that's just led to so much animosity and contempt, and they've continued to lose on that front. So maybe if they can get Goodell, they concede a little bit of power. You get marijuana taken off the banned substance list. Those would be wins.
Or just stop testing for it altogether. Just you know, like the NBA doesn't test for marijuana. Just stop testing for it altogether, and whatever happens, happens. You know, if anybody gets popped for it on a legal from a legal standpoint, they got to deal with it in that regard, but not just as far as their rules. Yeah, and I agree. The commissioner's power is a big thing. It has generated so much animosity, as you say, anger, rage, whatever it is. James Harrison just outright called him a crook a couple of days ago in an interview. He talked about the crook. He goes, I mean, the commissioner, Roger Goodell. And so there is so much animosity toward him being judge, jury, and executioner. That will definitely be a part of the next negotiation. But the end game here is you're right. The average career in the league lasts 3.5 years. If you're in the league now, and you're still in it 5 years from now, you are bucking the odds in a big, big way because you are not supposed to be. And, for them to try to put money aside now for a day they may never, have to face, I just can't imagine it really, you know, affecting too many players. Scott Petrak, great stuff. Scott, thanks for your input on Josh Gordon. We're going to watch the situation closely, obviously, and we'd love to talk to you again next week as we get ready, all right?
Sounds good, Bobby.
Thank you, Scott. Scott Petrak joining us, talking a little preseason NFL football. Josh Gordon could be on the block. Well, a lot of teams want him to be on the block. The Browns are not likely to put him there. All right, we'll get into hour number two. We got a lot more to come up, including Kevin Durant and his Olympic experience being a good thing for contenders of the Golden State Warriors. How and why? It's probably not what you think. I'll explain that in just a bit. We're going to talk more about the Madden ratings. Do you agree with them or not? And Tim Tebow is angering a lot of people because 20 major league teams have said they will send scouts to his workout on August 30th. Some believe he doesn't deserve that attention. We'll talk more about that as we continue the extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5.
And a 1-2 pitch to Chris Davis. Swung on and missed. Carrasco gets him his 7th strikeout of the night. The A's strand a pair. And an overturned call keeps this a scoreless game through 6. He launches one to deep right. Is it fair or is it foul? It is gone. Carlos Santana with home run number 27. Puts the first run of the night on the scoreboard.
He was standing at home plate, Matt, like, oh, my goodness, please stay fair, and it just barely does.
Yes. Did he go? He did, and this game's over. Andrew Miller strikes out the side, notches his 11th save of the year.
Wow, look at that.
Looks like Reed wasn't expecting that pass, but it goes for Gordon, who's got the ball, and a Cleveland Brown touchdown. He was working on Will Blackman at 21-yard strike.
Josh Gordon already over 100 yards.
Flea flicker.
He's got Gordon. Touchdown, Browns.
Especially even in the preseason. A lot of guys don't take that serious. Every opportunity to get out there, show what you can do. I think it means a lot, and guys should take it seriously, and I definitely do take it seriously, and I'd like to have fun while I'm doing here. Away from the field, I mean, like I said, it's a lot of mental reps. In meetings, taking a lot more notes, trying to pick up the offense a lot quicker compared to other guys that's been here. They've been here a long time. So I got a lot of room to have. But I feel just as strong, just as fast as I ever felt before. If not stronger, if not faster. We'll see how my production is, and we'll go from there once they evaluate and get some stuff on film. And at least I'll be able to tell how I feel once I get out there. Okay.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Onward we roll, and it is hour number two right here, starting at 10 minutes after 4 on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Thanks to Scott Petrak. Do you agree, Jim Cushlin? You only got in a little piece there. Do you really believe that if somebody offered the Browns a first-round draft pick for Josh Gordon right now, do you think they would take it or turn it down?
I'm not sure what they would do. I would seriously consider, if I was up there, I would. I've been thinking about this for a good chunk of the day, especially when I came across that he may be a restricted free agent, because to me that changes the game of the, any of these possible negotiations, because, you know, the Browns could match, kind of like the NBA, but if they lose out on him, they get some kind of draft pick. And, you know, if I'm in the front office, I'm seriously entertaining some of these phone calls, I ask for absolutely no less than a second right now. The Browns are in kind of the twisted way, the driver's seat, in terms of however these possible calls may go at this moment in time. That could change, but right now they're kind of in the driver's seat. I would ask for no less than a second.
I don't even know if I would take a second. I would want it to be a first.
You want it to be a first. I would take no less than a second, just on the grounds if you could still do things with second. Others may argue back to the grounds he was a second rounder kind of thing.
Yeah, but as Scott said, he's first round talent.
Oh yeah,
he's potentially, based on 1 year in 2013, he's potentially Hall of Fame talent. That means going to the Hall. I mean, he's got that kind of ability. And he can make those kinds of plays for however many periods or short of a period of time that he would be in the league.
Right.
Because of that, I would insist that it be something along the lines of what I said earlier on, and that is a conditional thing. I might say, okay, it'll be a first or a second round pick. A second round pick if he flames out and you don't get anything, and if he gets suspended again and you don't get a lot of production from him, then we'll only get your second round pick in the next draft. But if he plays all 15 or 16 games, or if he plays, or if he catches, say, 1,000 yards worth of receptions, or anything of that nature, yeah, somewhere close to that, then it becomes a first-round pick. Because it's got to be, compensation has to be equal.
Yeah.
And from the Brown standpoint, you could very easily, because it's team-friendly. If it is indeed restricted free agent status, as we talked about it being next year, and what's his salary? $850,000?
Yep, yeah, because of all these things that have happened, he's only going to make about $860,000 this year. So whether you're the Browns or some other team, if you offer $6-7 million, $3.5 to $4 guaranteed, that's a hefty pay raise relative to what he's been getting in.
That's exactly right. So it's peanuts. I mean, it really, really is. It's there's
that's what happens when you get in trouble all the time.
From that standpoint, what?
That's what happens when you get in trouble all the time.
Yeah. So it's very, very, you know, limited and low risk for the Browns from that standpoint to keep him there. If somebody wants him bad enough, you got to make sure that it is a first. And the reason why you would still even want to do that is, again, because let's suppose he has a great season. Let's suppose he puts up the same kind of wonderful numbers that he did in 2013. Whoever offers him a contract as a restricted free agent is going to make it extraordinarily expensive for you to keep him, in which case you are still in a situation where he might burn you. If you give him, let's say you give him, what's the highest receiver contract in the league right now? Who's the highest paid receiver in the NFL right now? Let's take a second to look that up just for the sake of discussion. Highest paid NFL receiver at this point in time, it looks like, is Julio Jones. His contract value is $71,250,000. At least that's the first thing that I just came up. Okay. Let's say somebody says, and it's interesting because isn't that who Scott Petrak compared him to?
Right. Yep.
You know, in body size and style, et cetera, et cetera. So if somebody comes up here and offers him a $70 million contract, what would be the signing bonus in a deal like that? Probably in the neighborhood of 40 of it, 30, 20, 35, 40 of it would be guaranteed, maybe a little over half of it based on the way some recent contracts have gone. Would it be less? Would it be 30 million? Guaranteed?
Yeah, basically 35 and a half initially guaranteed on Julio Jones, to put some of this in perspective.
There you go. I guessed 40 to 35. It was 35 and a half, so I'm kind of in the ballpark.
Yes.
I'm doing pretty well. Am I just completely out of the blue guesses here? But okay, so now are you willing to guarantee $35 million to a guy, again, who's one bad test or skip test away from a new ban? Not a new four-gamer. Not a new one-year suspension like Martavis Bryant of the Steelers is under right now. A new ban from the league.
Which is what it would be in, probably, in his case.
It is, because it already was.
Right, that's my point.
This last one was a ban. It wasn't a suspension. Again, for people who don't know the difference, a suspension has a beginning and an end date. It's a suspension for a period of time. 4 games, 1 year, whatever the case is. A ban is indefinite. you are suspended, you are banned from the league permanently or indefinitely until such time as the commissioner feels sees fit to remove that ban.
Right.
And allow you to come back in. You have to apply for reinstatement and show the changes in your life, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So you're still one bad, one toke away from losing $35 million guaranteed dollars in a deal such as that. So if you're the Browns, maybe you're thinking to yourself, I don't want to touch that long-term deal for that kind of market value, which he might have if he has another brilliant year this year like he had in 2013. I don't want to get in the neighborhood of Julio Jones, Demaryius Thomas, Dez Bryant, and some of these high dollar receivers because I know I can't rely on him. But I also don't want to walk away let him walk away to join whoever offers him that for no compensation. So let's get the compensation while we can.
Right.
Let's not take the chance. Let's get the first round pick or the second, which could become conditionally a first round pick in a kind of a suggestion that I made a few minutes ago. I have to think that if I'm in the front office, if I'm Sashi Brown, he's the one making all the personnel decisions now. Dee Podesta does the analytics. Sashi Brown, I think, is the one calling all these shots, right? If I'm sitting here taking that phone call, I'm thinking, given all of the above, if he has a breakout year this year, another really, really good year, and he becomes a restricted free agent next year, and the offer is too high, and I don't want to have to pay that guaranteed money as part of that offer to match it and sign him, maybe I will take that call right now and make that deal.
You know, as I've been looking at this, and Scott didn't seem so sure either, and this is because just like whenever we're talking about this stuff in the NBA, really trying to look at the nitty-gritty of these things is completely explosive headache-inducing. The possibility that he's a restricted free agent is really what needs to be figured out here, because that changes how the negotiations go down. What I'm trying to say is I've been looking at some of this and thinking, would the Browns be in a better position to give him some kind of longer-term deal now? They won't have to pay him anywhere near a Julio Jones type of deal. You triple his or quadruple what he's going to make this year, and you're talking $4 million, maybe $5 million. There'd obviously be stipulations with his issues, and not to mention the guaranteed and what would be unguaranteed. If he's a restricted, you may not want to obviously do that, because being restricted, this works similar to the NBA, where any team swoops in and the Browns have the right to offer him, or I should say match the offer. And the whole point of this coming in is, I think why it's a question is, part of under restricted free agency in the NFL, as a player has to have three cured seasons, no more or less. And I may have said that wrong, sorry.
Yeah, that's right.
But, and this is where the question, I think, comes in, because the suspension year, i.e. all of last year, means he only was in the league and actually stepped on the field for three seasons, 12, almost all of 13, and those few games in 2014. And he's been out ever since. So he's only been on for 3 years. That's why he's in this kind of limbo, because restricted doesn't come up, as I mentioned to Scott. Restricted free agents don't come up much in the NFL because it has to be a three-season thing, and most rookie deals on anyone of significance anyway, where this would come into play,
right,
they're all four-year deals. So they're skipping over this concept entirely. But due to his suspension is what it's looking, or his banishment, I should say, is making this a possibility. And if he really is a restricted free agent, then the Browns hold all the cards, because they can offer him something now. They can wait, see what he does this year. If he keeps his nose clean and performs anywhere close to 2013, then the Browns will be in a position to match whatever's out there. And if he does play well, keeps his nose clean, this guy's only 25.
Oh, yeah.
A three-year deal is 28. So you're not talking, and we're not talking some kind of over-the-hill guy. Maybe he's a little rusty, or would be, because he hasn't been on the field in game situations a lot, but he's certainly going to have fresh legs. And Scott pointed out, he looks, outside of being a little overweight, he looks and like the normal Josh Gordon.
Well, that's
Gordon.
What Joe Haden pointed out.
And Joe Haden, yeah, that's what you're right. You're right. Scott pointing out what Joe Haden said. And I could believe that. With all the banishment things, of course the guy's going to put on a few pounds, but if he's still got the speed and could still actually catch the ball, that's mainly what the Browns need out of Josh Gordon, and he'd be an interesting piece going forward. It's not like it's some guy that's like, oh, he's a star and the Browns are the Browns. They need to just trade him to get more picks. Not necessarily in this guy's case. Obviously, it's all dependent, whether it's in Cleveland or elsewhere, of him keeping his nose clean.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt. And that's the reason why you might be able to get something done early, because he knows he is also one, just one away from, or away as I make my drug sound effects, from being banned again. He might take a very, very undervalued, extension. You know,
especially if it guarantees $5 to $10 million overall. At this point in his life and career, he'd be stupid not to take such a deal.
If they offer him, say, for example, just a 3-year deal, you know, a 3-year deal somewhere in the neighborhood of, I don't know, $30 million, $10 million a year, and they'll guarantee 12 of that, or 15.
You got to take that deal if you're Gordon. You've only basically made $3 million out of your quote unquote career so far. You got to take that.
Yeah, he might take that, but until he catches 1,700 yards worth of passes again.
Right.
And then he sees where he is in comparison to the other league leaders, and they're making, you know, $24 million. Well, now it's not that much, but, you know, but they're making these huge contracts that I just mentioned a few moments ago, and he's going to want to negotiate. His agents are not going to want to probably advise him to take that either. Maybe they'll tell him to take a year, you know, sign a 1-year extension. Sign a 1-year after your restricted free agent year for, you know, X amount of dollars. But, you know, then you're still not only one bad decision from the drug standpoint away, but you're also one injury away from never getting that long-term deal. So it's a coin flip. It's a tough decision in a league without guaranteed contracts for both the player, the team, and the agent advising that player on how long of a deal you should take and how much you should take,
right,
and for the team, whether or not you want to offer that much given the history here, and whether or not maybe you want to make him somebody else's problem.
Right.
Give me a high enough draft pick and he's yours and you figure it out.
And again, I'm trying to part of my thinking is, ever since I saw earlier when I was looking up what his contract was, because I became curious after hearing all these rumors too this morning, and of course, we don't know what teams are involved, we just know that reports are the phones are ringing, you know, as I suppose they should be if teams are willing to, he's got the talent. We all know that. But this whole restricted free agency, I keep coming back to, and I'm trying to find out definitions. I found this on a site. This is referencing Article 8, Section 1-34 of the current NFL CBA, the one on the accrued seasons. In order to accrue a season, a player must be on, or should have been on, full pay status for 6 or more regular season games. That's 12, 13, and 14 for Josh Gordon, but not 15. That's why he's only at 3, and that's why SportTrack, for example, is a good site if you're curious out there of seeing what your NFL players' contracts are. That's why it's listing Josh Gordon as an RFA, because a suspension obviously wouldn't count in this situation. Only those 3 years he actually, no matter how many few games it was, and they were all 6 or more. That's why it's only 3 seasons, but that's the whole key. The game plan changes in how you would handle these trade situations if he's an unrestricted free agent this coming winter.
Yeah, that's a very good point. So it's interesting. So let's open it up. If you've got thoughts on this, if you're a Browns fan, or you know what, even if you're a Lions fan, and this is just a discussion of a player like Josh Gordon, even if it's not him, would you roll the dice and sign this guy to a long-term deal, knowing full well that market value is going to force you to pay a ton of guaranteed dollars to a guy who is not guaranteed to be on the field? Or would you entertain trade offers for him, as they are certainly being made right now, according to virtually every report?
And the synopsis for my point of view is, you listen to these calls, You demand a first and say you truly won't accept anything less than a second, and then and if you don't get what you want, then you proceed on, because in theory you should have the restricted free agency in your back pocket. So if somebody offers him, because he has a good season and keeps his nose clean, a ridiculous deal, you'd have the ability to match it, the Cleveland Browns in this case, and he's only 25, or going to be 25 for this season, so it's not like he's over the hill or anything.
Right, that's very true.
That'd be my game plan. As I've looked at this all day, that's what I would do.
Yeah, that's very true. So I'm interested to see what people would do with this. Again, you don't have to be a Browns fan. It's just a Browns story because it's Josh Gordon. But the rest of the league is apparently inquiring about Josh Gordon and his availability. So if you want to get into that, we can get into that also. The other thing we talked about, and this one is remotely related to the Lions as well, because it has to do with Sam Martin, who told the Detroit Free Press that, quote, this is going to be a trial and error thing. So we won't really know we won't really know until we start doing it. It's not going to be an every time thing, I don't think, but I think every team is at least going to have that in the bag. The high short ball, keep it out of the end zone type kick. So yeah, I think there's going to be more returns this year than ever. And, of course, we're talking about kickoffs, and we're talking about the new touchback rule that's going to put the ball after a touchback at the 25. And, Jim, I don't understand what the NFL is doing, and I don't know if the NFL understands what they're doing. The reason they moved the kickoff line up, is because they wanted to reduce the number of kickoff returns to avoid the number of high-speed impact collisions that happen on kickoffs. So they move it up so they increase more touchbacks. But then they disincentivize the kicking team to kicking it out of the end zone and making it a touchback, because now they're giving the offense or the returning team an extra 5 right out of the gate. They're starting at the 25. So as Sam Martin says, look, you know, we're gonna make sure that we're popping it up. Maybe, I don't know if it's every time, but a lot of times we're gonna make sure we're popping it up short inside of the 10-yard line, but outside of the goal line, so there's no touchback. So they got to earn the 25, not just be handed the 25 on a very easy to do pop out of the end zone. And I don't understand why the NFL would be changing this and undoing what they did. Personally,
well, they're undoing what they did because ever since they moved the kickoff up, the number of touchbacks has spiked almost exponentially.
Well, that's their goal, though. That's what I mean.
That was their goal.
So why undo what you intentionally did? You intentionally wanted more touchbacks.
My theory, safety aside, I bet they've been getting enough grumblings from players and coaches on the down low about it. That they don't kind of like this. That
I don't
it's getting
know about
rid of the
players
kickoff.
And coaches, but I guarantee you they've heard from fans, because
yes.
The kickoff used to be one of the most exciting plays in football, and now it is a yawn. It's another commercial. You know what I mean?
It's because a commercial, you have a touchdown. But there's actually a ball being used in it. Basically,
it's another commercial. I mean, you know, after a touchdown, an extra point, they go to commercial break.
Right.
Then they come back and they have the kickoff, and then they go to another commercial break.
Right.
Essentially, it's become another commercial. Nobody is rushing back to their seat if they want to use the bathroom after a touchdown during the commercial break. They're not rushing back to their seat to see a kickoff that goes through the end zone, and it's a touchback, and then the next commercial. They're staying away. They're annoyed by it. They're bored by it. They have no interest in it. It's just another commercial. So I bet it's probably more from... than it is for
players
and coaches.
You know, you've got a good point. It's probably more fan than it would be players and coaches.
Well,
that's a good point.
Not fans directly,
right?
Because not too many fans have direct access to NFL officials, but you know who does? The networks. I promise you, the networks are looking at the ratings, and they're looking at where the viewership drops, and it's going to be in things like this. The networks listen to their advertisers. The advertisers watch the numbers. The advertisers say, hey, nobody's even watching our commercials because they're walking away from this thing because they're annoyed by it.
Or they do what
they
I do and DVR the game and
things,
watch it
the
later.
Fans, the fans speak through the networks and through the advertisers, and that is probably what they're doing. But I guess my point to that, Jim, was... they undid what they intentionally did.
Yep.
They intentionally. It wasn't an unintended byproduct that the touchbacks went through the roof, spiked through the roof. That was the direct intention of the league. Now that they are getting what they wanted, they're probably hearing the grumbling, like we said. And they're saying, okay, we need to cut down on the number of touchbacks. We need returns. So what do? Do we back the kickoff line back to where it was before?
No,
and
that's
we were
too
wrong?
Sane and logical.
Yeah, well, but and it's also impossible to expect them with their massive egos to do something that would essentially force them to say we were wrong. We shouldn't have moved it up in the first place. It was a bad call on our part. And all that stuff we sold the fans and the media about player safety being paramount, now we have to backtrack on.
It feels like a ripping the Band-Aid thing off. They should have just gone this route that you're saying, just admitted it, but for obvious reasons they can't do that.
Well, they can't, like I said, because, that's not even a Band-Aid. That's saying we don't value player safety as much as we said we did. Remember, their argument...
right.
As to why they moved the line up was because we want fewer collisions and fewer injuries, and we look at the statistics and we look at the charts and we see more injuries, and I don't even know what the numbers are, but I do know that many have questioned their validity. But the number of injuries that happen on certain special teams plays like kickoffs because of high speed guys getting full running starts and then slamming into one another. So they're basically saying we're willing to sacrifice one of the exciting plays in football most of the time, which is a kickoff return, in the interest of player safety. If moving the lineup increases the number of touchbacks, that's something we're willing to sacrifice in the interest of player safety. So, Jim, if they back off of that now and say we're moving the line back, we shouldn't have done it, now they have to address all of the media that are going to say, wait a second, are you now saying you don't care about the player safety that you made such a big deal about when you moved it back? Or, I'm sorry, when you moved it up? And they have no answer for that. So the alternative is what? To find a way to get kickoffs back into the game without admitting we were wrong and we don't care about player safety. So the answer is we're going to penalize the kickoff team a little bit for kicking them all through the end zone. Now the receiving team gets it at the 25. So this way, they get kind of the best of both worlds. They don't have to eat their words and admit that they were wrong about doing it in the first place and that player safety isn't a concern for them anymore. They can stay with the, hey, we still moved it up because we still want to encourage the touchback in order to save players from a huge high-speed collision. But that'll be up to the kicking team because it is a 25-yard start now for the receiving team if they do that. It puts the onus on the kicking team's head coach and special teams coach and what they want to decide instead of putting the onus on themselves to explain their very mysterious reason for pushing the kickoff line up and then discouraging kick touchbacks by giving them the 25-yard line.
And I can't disagree with what Sam Martin said and what some other coaches right now around the league as a result of this are dabbling. They want to play the percentages, and they figure, okay, if the touchback line's the 25 and my kicker can at least get it between the 10 and the goal line, then odds are we're going to stop that guy before he gets to the 25, and they're going to be starting farther back. From a coach's standpoint, I can't argue at all with that particular idea. It's very similar to what Mike Tomlin specifically in Pittsburgh, and there was an injury, of course, that helped prolong this, but he was the most specific last year of basically saying, okay, you're moving my extra point back. The heck with you. I'm going for two a whole bunch of times now.
Yeah.
I can't argue from a coach's perspective that they would do this. I would consider doing it too, especially if I know the team doesn't have a good return guy of any kind, really, through my scouting. Then, I'm going to want that ball dropping on the ground on the kick between the 10 and the goal, so somebody has to pick it up, and they'll most likely be tackled before
the
25.
Get swarmed before they get to the man, as Scott said, maybe even the 20. Here's an indicator of where we are. This is just preseason, so take it for what it's worth. Very, very small sample size. But touchbacks last season were 56%. All right, and that's actually lower than I thought it would have been.
I was just thinking, that sounds lower than I would have thought. I was thinking more like 65-70.
And this is quoting the Free Press, the Detroit Free Press.
Okay.
So take it for what it is here. You know, they're quoting the stat. 56% of the kickoffs. Now, you have to understand, too, Jim, every kickoff is counted in that, including onside kicks.
That's true.
Okay, so that can very easily skew the number. The number of intentionally attempted. And then, of course, also open-air stadium fall and winter kicks count, too, in which there may be swirling winds, in which it's a lot harder to get the touchback. Okay, it's not always dome, perfect weather conditions.
Right.
So be that as it may, touchbacks were 56% of the kickoffs last year, and that dipped 13% down to 43% in week one of this preseason, according to the Free Press, which is citing Pro Football Talk. Lions coach Jim Caldwell says teams often kick short during exhibition play in order to evaluate players fighting for special team spots on coverage units, which I understand.
Which is actually a twisted practice for doing the kicker to kick this way.
Because
they just like to boot it. Think Sebastian Janikowski, I swear every time a kickoff is going on, he's trying to kick it purposely through the uprights,
Swear. But in preseason, maybe not so much, because they want to see kick.
Exactly.
But now that the 25 is going to be in play here, you know, Janikowski's leg power could work against him. He's going to have to work on what they're calling the mortar kicks, like throwing a mortar, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Martin had 40 touchbacks on his 73 kickoffs last year. He said he practiced mortar kicks a lot this offseason in case the Lions decide to utilize the strategy. And quote, I think it's just like any other position or play. You have to have options. You don't want to be a one-trick pony. So along with numerous kicks, guys can even start squibbing it more too. If they want to make sure it doesn't go all the way through the end zone. And we know that squib kicks are oftentimes a very, very difficult thing for receiving teams to deal with because it's bouncing around and the up guy doesn't know if he should get it or let it squib back to the deep guy who's still the most dangerous threat, etc. So squib kicks could certainly be in play more as well if teams are trying to avoid the touchback. So that along with numerous kicks, guys can squib it more. Martin said it's going to be interesting to see. I think you're going to see a variety of different kicks coming now, but not just deep kicks anymore. And I think he's spot on. Caldwell said we probably may be able to use a little more definitive than anybody else because we're indoors 13 times out of 16 games. So in other words, the swirling winds and the things that I talked about won't necessarily be a factor. Wet field conditions won't be a factor. You know, where the kicker in a kickoff plants and slides a little bit and can't get all of it, so therefore that one's in play. That's where I think that 56 comes into play, Jim, a lot more than people realize. But he said, we're indoors, but I think still you've got to be able to handle them accordingly. Some teams, depending on who they are, you may decide to approach it one way and change it up for another, but there will be some different approaches, I guarantee you, with that new rule. I don't necessarily like the rule. Here's what I've learned from all of this. The game wasn't broken. Why are they trying to fix it? Kickoffs were not ending careers. People weren't getting, and I know because I talked about this with respect to the extra points, and they were trying to pinpoint the number of injuries, particularly head injuries, if that was a factor, and I don't even think it was, that occur on special teams plays like the extra point or the extra point two-point try or the kickoff or the punt or kickoff return or punt return. And the numbers were not definitive enough to say we need to address this, that an inordinate or a disparate number of injuries, particularly head injuries, which is all the rage now, that there is a disproportionate number of head injuries that are occurring on these specific special teams plays. If they determined that, we might have a conversation. But they don't have that disproportional number to justify first moving the kickoff line up and then secondly now saying, okay, we wish we hadn't done that. We're going to penalize the receiving team for, or I'm sorry, the kicking team for kicking the ball out of the end zone with a touchback. It wasn't broken. They really should have touched neither one of those things. Just let the game go on. And I hope they remember that when it comes to any of the other silly rules that they're talking about when it comes to the kicking game and the extra point, et cetera, et cetera. All right. We want to hear how you feel about this, too. 866-240-1065 is the number to join us. 866-240-1065. Got a few more stories to get to as well, including the NBA story of the day. We have to have one almost every other day, even though we're in the deep part of the offseason. Kevin Durant played for the U.S. Olympic team. He had an experience there that I believe is going to be good for the Cleveland Cavaliers or for the San Antonio Spurs or for the L.A. Clippers or for any of the other contenders to the Golden State Warriors in this upcoming season. You don't know what I'm talking about. I will explain. Remind me to do so coming up next right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. And, oh, by the way, before we move on, you know what I did yesterday that I want to replicate again today? I want to hook you up with some baseball tickets. You want to go see the Hens and the Clippers? Not those L.A. Clippers I referenced. The Columbus Clippers? I got Hens and Clips tickets for this Friday. As a matter of fact, I'm going to give a couple pairs away because I've got them. I'll give them to callers 10 and 11 right now at 5th Third Field. If you want to see the Toledo Mud Hens and the Columbus Clippers, callers 10 and 11. What did I say, 9 and 10 or 10 and 11? We'll go 10 and 11. Those tickets are yours, a pair for each of you. If you are the 10th or 11th callers, 866-240-1065. Good luck from the ticket.
A France extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
4:44, so 16 minutes of outstanding awesomeness left for you this afternoon on the extravaganza. Mike Miller and Drive Time will stay awesome with you coming up at 5 o'clock. Congratulations to Randy Damron of Toledo and to Jimmy Comer of Perrysburg. They were the winners of the Hens tickets, so they're going to go down to the ball yard at 5th Third and watch the Hens and the Clippers on Friday.
We got a couple more of those over the course of the next few days, so stay tuned.
I was just about to say, we're not done with those. We've got another one. If you didn't win them today, you might have a shot at it tomorrow and on Thursday as well. We won't give away any on Friday. It'll be a little too close to first pitch time for you to come and get them. Anyway, getting back to the point. In fact, you know what? Before I go to the point on Kevin Durant that I've been meaning to talk about for 2 days now, I want to remind you about college football and about the unbelievable deals available to you at the Buckeye Store and more, the College and Pro Superstore. Football season is just about here, and that means the time is now. Preseason sale is off and running. 10% store-wide savings. That means on everything, including hundreds of new Nike products that are in stock now for Ohio State and Michigan. If you get up and into the Buckeye Store early, then you take advantage of doorbuster items at 50 to 75% off of those each and every day. Look for Big Brutus on the Roof in Sylvania, 5700 Monroe. It's right between Ralphie's and Dave's in front of ProMedica. And in fact, that new inflatable Brutus, you can pick that up if you want it for your front porch or your front yard as well. Available for delivery by August 25th. And don't forget the fan zones for all the other teams you love besides Buckeyes and Wolverines, including the Irish, the Spartans, the Rockets, the Falcons, and the Tigers. Hundreds of new products arriving daily at the largest store in Ohio dedicated to Buckeye gear, the Buckeye Store and more, Starlight Plaza in Sylvania at 5700 Monroe. Kevin Durant. was easily the best player in the gold medal game, clinching the gold medal for the U.S. in their rematch against Serbia, whom they beat only by 3 earlier in the Olympics. Kevin Durant went off, and he was a central figure in the Olympic story for Team USA for that reason, but also because he's just a central figure in basketball now, as he is the former MVP who came within a whisper of beating the Golden State Warriors to go to the NBA Finals to face off against LeBron James. But he and his Thunder blew a 3-1 series lead, as you know by now. Unbelievable that they gave that up. And that cost him a chance at an NBA Finals and a championship. And now, after the season ended when free agency got here, he just did the unthinkable. Instead of the old adage of if you can't, it is the old adage, if you can't beat them, join them, he decided, I can't beat the Warriors, so I'll go join the Warriors and try to find championships that way. It didn't ride well with a lot of folks. It just didn't. It didn't sit well with me, I can tell you that. It bothers me. First of all, I wanted him to stay in Oklahoma City, or I wanted him to go somewhere else where he could carry a team to a championship, not just be part of an already championship caliber team, one that won the championship last season, then had a record NBA record 73 wins this season, and a narrow game 7 loss to LeBron and the Cavaliers in the finals. So having said all of that, he goes into the Olympics and he does a tremendous job, particularly in the gold medal game. And he was talking to Michael Lee of The Vertical, which is a hoops website. And in this, he described the Olympic experience as being very, very therapeutic for himself, that he needed this. Quoting The Vertical, during an emotional summer in which he left behind his first professional franchise, he was miscast as a villain for siding with a former enemy and found himself having to defend his character. Team USA provided a much-needed sanctuary. For nearly a month, Durant got to play the game he loves, bond with some new and old friends, and win without sweating any manufactured controversies or external second-guessing. It was therapy for me, he said, after making a big change in my life. He said this, he told The Vertical this in the depth of the Carioca Arena about an hour after scoring 30 points in that gold medal clinching victory. He said, this made my life easier. I knew backlash was coming. It was definitely different for me. But to come here in an environment where people accepted me and didn't care about anything except being my buddy, that's what I needed. Now, I looked in the article that he that quoted him, which is from The Vertical, the website The Vertical. I looked for the rest of the quote that I got from First Take this morning on ESPN television. And as I tell you all the time, I monitor not only ESPN Radio and Mike every morning, and a little bit of Le Batard, although he's not my favorite show. I go to First Take, watch some TV, catch some of the discussions there and see what's going on, etc. And on First Take this morning, they quoted Kevin Durant as also saying that playing for Team USA gave him a chance to not be the villain for a while, but to be the hero. Not being the villain, but being the hero. Now, I don't have that quote in front of me. Like I said, I looked for it, but I just can't find that exact quote. I don't think it matters too terribly much, however. And here's the reason why. What I just read to you that I can quote directly from The Vertical says pretty much the same thing. And I tease this with what Kevin Durant experienced at the Olympics is going to be a blessing, a positive thing, for the Cleveland Cavaliers, who, if you listen to Vegas, are destined for another collision course in the NBA Finals with the Golden State Warriors, now featuring Kevin Durant alongside Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, Draymond Green, et al. And what I mean by that is this, and it's not just the Cavs, it benefits everybody trying to unseat the Western Conference champion Warriors. Kevin Durant has essentially admitted he doesn't like being the bad guy. He likes being liked. It's important to him that fans cheer him. It's important to him and his psyche that he is favored and not cast as a heel, if you will, in WWE parlance. He doesn't like being the villain. Now, in the First Take piece that I told you, they quoted him as saying that this gave him a chance, this therapeutic time with the Olympics, to be cheered again as the hero instead of being cast as the villain. That certainly makes it very plain. But if you read those words again or listen to them as I read them again to you, even without that direct quote, it kind of says the same thing. Quote, I knew a backlash was coming. It was definitely different for me. But to come here in an environment where people accepted me and didn't care about anything except being my buddy, that's what I needed. This is a great thing for the Cleveland Cavaliers and other teams in the NBA to know. Because Kevin Durant is a villain. And if it's important to him to be liked, to be people's buddies, to be cheered, to be the hero instead of the villain, he is in for a rude, rude, rude experience. Because everywhere he goes in the National Basketball Association, starting in, when do we start, November?
Late October, last week of October.
That's not that far away, believe it or not.
No, it's not.
But everywhere they go, Kush, right, this guy and this team, they are now the villain.
They have to be.
They are the old Oakland Raiders. They are the, I don't know, the New England Patriots. They are the New York Yankees. They are the Dallas Cowboys. They are the team that everybody is going to love to hate. He's going to get booed in arenas where he used to get cheered. He's going to get booed when they win. He's going to get booed when they lose. He's going to get booed when he makes threes. He's going to get booed when he misses threes. He's going to get booed relentlessly because guess what? Most of the NBA's fan base now, which already maybe had a very tenuous relationship with the Warriors as it is because of their cockiness, now that they have added Kevin Durant, they are the villains in much the same way that LeBron, Wade, Bosch, and the Heat kind of embraced the villain's role when they went down there to Miami in 2010. Kevin Durant isn't embracing it, but it's there in much the same way it was for the Heat. He doesn't like being a villain. He doesn't like it when people aren't, quote, anything except my buddy, that's what I need, end quote. This could be a very good sign that mentally, emotionally, he might not be there and able to be the same player he was, dominating for the Warriors now instead of for the Thunder, along with Steph Curry and Klay Thompson and the rest. That the chemistry, the sharing, all of that stuff, it just might not be in Kevin Durant's wheelhouse to be where he's going to be hated instead of being beloved. That could be a really, really, really good sign for the teams trying to stop the Warriors from getting back to the finals, and then for the Cavaliers, who are expected to be back in the finals against the Warriors.
That's an interesting theory, and obviously, if it turns out that that's what Kevin Durant feels, then that's going to make the whole thing kind of interesting as we go through this upcoming season. And
his words.
Yeah. Boy, I'm not sure what to think of this, honestly. I mean, you know, the Warriors are going to have all that stuff on them anyway because
they have all the talent anyway. I mean, obviously the talent is off the charts.
Yes, no one's arguing that.
You know, I mean, the depth isn't really there, but the starting five especially, and maybe the top six in the rotation, are just off the charts. There's no question about that. They still have to find a better big man play, I think, than what they got last season, but particularly in the finals. But nonetheless, their talent is off the charts. But I'm just saying, you know, Kevin Durant owned Oklahoma City. And he owned pretty much every arena he walked in because people liked Kevin Durant. He was one of my favorite players. I've said this many times through the last several years of his time in the league on the radio. I've been saying how much I'm a huge Kevin Durant fan, not just because of his talent, which is also, quote, you know, I don't mean to be redundant, but it's off the charts, but because of his attitude, because he wasn't cocky, because he wasn't a punk,
right.
Because he wasn't, you know, he didn't act thuggishly. He won the MVP and gave one of the speeches for the ages about his mother being the real MVP here because she made everything possible for him. He's just one of those likable, marketable superstars that just don't come along very often. And that was his persona, and he loved it. Now, as you heard him say after the Olympics, I needed the therapy of the Olympics because I needed to be cheered again because I don't like being the villain. I like being the hero. I like being the guy that people cheer for rather than the guy people boo. I don't soak up and absorb the boos. I don't like them. I repel them. I try to block them out. And you know what else, Jim? If he likes to be the hero, if that is indeed the word that he used that they quoted on First Take, that also brings into question who's going to take the last shot in a one-point game with 4 seconds on the clock. Is he going to demand it because he's the hero? Is Curry going to be willing to give that that spot up because that's been his? Curry and Clay, are they going to defer to him? Is he going to be mad if Steve Kerr calls up the final shot for Curry instead? Because he likes to be the hero, his words. I'm not trying to read too much into what he said. I know I am a little bit. I'm playing a little bit of psychoanalyst here. But I don't think this is a guy who likes being booed. He doesn't like being the villain. And he certainly doesn't like not being the hero. And that could be a very, very good thing for the teams trying to knock them down, including the Cavaliers again. All right, that's where we have to leave it. We don't have time to analyze it any further than I just did from the couch. But we're done. Mike Miller is coming up next with Drive Time. Appreciate you being a part of the show. We'll have another baseball update tomorrow. Tigers and Twins, Indians and A's. We'll see where the AL Central race and the wild card races stand as we bring you another one tomorrow.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.